White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the debut edition of my new radio show on this auspicious date of June 9th, 2012. I have named it Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn Yeager, really so that people will remember just when it is by the title. I want to thank Tan Stoffel for making it possible for this program to go on the air, and I would like all of you to appreciate the substantial amount of work and concern he has put into this. We, and I'm including all of the listeners, are the recipients of Tan Stoffel's talent and commitment. I have the honor of having as my guest today the well-known French revisionist Vincent Renoir. I have previously had Vincent on my program when I was doing the revisionist report at RBN. This was last June, just about 1 year ago. So all of my programs, by the way, have been erased from the RBN archives that I did there, but they are all available on my website, carolynyeager.com, if you look under Radio Archives and then the revisionist report. And Vincent's program is like the second or third one listed there. It is currently just after 8 p.m. in France, while it is just after 1 p.m. where I am, so I'll say good evening, Vincent, and welcome to my new Saturday afternoon program.
Yes, good evening, Caroline, and hello to the listeners.
Well, everyone is looking forward to the show, I can tell you, to hearing from you. I don't know when the last time you did a radio interview in English for the American audience, so I know that there's a lot of listeners who are happy to be hearing this, and they'll be downloading it too. So I want to start out by giving a few basics about you and asking you to comment as I'm doing so, because I'm not going to go into it too deeply right here in the beginning. As I said, we're going to go more deeply into the work that you've done in the second hour. This hour will be more about you and your life experience and what's happened to you in revisionism and how your general beliefs, political beliefs, and so on, and also your persecution. So now your current website is www.phdmn.org, which really is the No Holes, No Holocaust site that gives your latest, this is your latest project, I think, right? No Holes, No Holocaust, defending the attackers of Robert Faurisson's work.
Yes. First, my internet is www.phdmn.org. PhDNM.
Oh, NM, not MN. Yes. Oh, I have it backwards. And no wonder I had a problem. All right, I'm sorry. PhD, N as in Nancy, M as in man.
Yay.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, we'll get back to that later. Now, you were born in 1969, and you married in 1991, and you have seven children, or is it eight?
I have eight children, but I won't speak about my family now, my family position, because it's very hard. I have a lot of problems now with my wife, so I wouldn't like to speak about that.
Yes, but go ahead.
It's not very important now.
No, right. But the fact that if people are interested in that you did have a large family. And yes. You taught mathematics at professional secondary schools, Actually, you trained as a chemical engineer,
yes.
I think, and you weren't too excited about that work, so you decided you would prefer to be a teacher. So you were teaching mathematics, and in 1997, you had been working on some revisionist work on your school computer, which you weren't talking to anyone about or sharing it or anything, but somebody who was after you uncovered this and reported you, and you were fired. Your first political problem in France, you were fired by the French education minister after
yes.
they discovered these on your hard disk. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
So that began.
True.
And after that, you wrote a book about Orodor Sourgline, which I may not be pronouncing that too well, the massacre in the French village in June 1944, which was blamed on the German SS, and in which 640 civilians died. We'll talk about that later, but was that what you were working on in when you were a teacher?
Yes. It's right. All is right. I was working on this project when I was a mathematics teacher in France, and it was the project was at the end. I have finished, and at that time I put on the computer all the text to publish a book. It was my work at that time. I was typing the text to publish this book. Yes.
Okay, so you weren't actually working on the book at school on that computer. You just put the finished text on that computer so
yes,
that you
yes.
could do something with it. Okay, well, that's
because at that time I was very poor and I didn't have a computer, or it was it wasn't a good computer. But at school, I could use a good computer.
I see. Yes. All right. Yes, you were poor, because you had a family to support on your little teacher's salary. All right, is the now that's the first Holocaust revisionist work that you did, the Orodor Sourgline or Glane?
No, it's not the first. I wrote a book in 1993 about the cause of the Second World War. But
okay.
it was a book he didn't have success because I don't know why, but this book is not known today.
All right. Well, what was the name of that book, if you can translate it into English as well as it, say it in French?
Yes, the name of the book was Crimes Against Peace. Crimes Against Peace, yes, only. It was
okay.
A titular book.
All right.
But I wrote it with a lot of documents, and after I wrote some articles, with all the documents I used for this book. So now on my site, on my website, you can find some articles. It's this book, really, now, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, that are what's in this book. All right, I think that's...
Yes.
So it says on the Balder blog, and you know, I linked in my announcement to this, there's a long article about you there. It's a little bit old, but it's very good. It says that you're the author of several dozen brochures on diverse subjects, most dealing with World War II. So is that what he's speaking of there? What you
yes,
were
yes,
working on that then became that book?
Yes. A lot of text I publish on in booklets
mm-hmm.
are spread from this book. You know?
Yes, I do. Yes, that clarifies that. I would like to read those. I wish they were available.
But they are not. They don't exist in English. I'm sorry.
Yes.
And a lot of my studies don't exist in English. Perhaps one day, but.
Is that because there's no one available to translate them, or is there just no desire to translate them, or what?
I don't know. Exactly, I don't know. I think perhaps is I'm in France, you know, I'm not very known because you have Robert Faurisson, he is very known, and so I think that my name is not very known for in France. When you talk about revisionism, is Robert Faurisson, but it's not Vincent Renoir.
Well, except in the courts.
Yes, except yes. In the courts, I'm sure. Says yes, but for the public, no, it's Robert Faurisson.
Okay, all right. Well, now also. It says in this Balder blog that you were, at one time, you directed the French-speaking branch of VHO, which is the Institute for an Objective Historic View. People are very much familiar with VHO as an internet site, but I never knew it had that name before. Are you still, when was that? Or do you want to say anything about that, or would you rather not?
Sorry, I didn't understand. You speak about the site of the VHO?
Yes, and that you at one time directed the French-speaking branch of that site?
Oh, yeah. No. Four years ago, somebody created a site for me called VHO France. But on the large site of VHO, it was not me.
All right, I see. Okay, well, that's good clarification, too. So now let me tell you that, in my opinion, you are one of the few what I call true revisionists, in that you don't just take a position on other people's work, but you initiate your own projects, you do new and original research, you write, produce, and distribute it. So you are self-motivated and what I have coined self-initiating. In other words, I would say, you know, you're not a follower at all, but a leader, and you forge your own path according to your own ideas and convictions. And those ideas and convictions, I think, are summed up in the way you have sometimes described yourself as a, quote, Catholic, National Socialist, and revisionist. So my question is it in that order? Is that how you see yourself, in that order?
Yes, I see myself in that order, and you're right to say that I don't want to be a follower, because I think that when I began to write, I said I want to give new things to my readers. I don't want to speak about things already known.
Exactly. That's what I notice about you very much. And there are very few of these true revisionists who are doing groundbreaking, or, you know, breaking, going into new areas that have and bringing us new information, in my opinion. But there are a lot of people, and we know they mostly have well-known names. So, there are a lot of people who are revisionists, but they call themselves revisionists, but only because they agree with the revisionist position, right?
Yes. I'm sure you're right. There is very few revisionists who make research, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Very, very few. I like doing research. I like discover new things. I like to go to libraries or archives, you know, and finding the new documents, and for me it's my life.
Excellent. Well, we're grateful that it is, that you like that, and that's what it takes. You have to like doing this. You know, I understand that very well. Oh, now getting to your few, of course, you were born a Catholic, and you still have your Catholic faith. You never turned against that, and that's an important part of your life. And then next comes you list National Socialism. Did you become a National Socialist before you became a revisionist? And is that why that's in that order? First you were a Catholic, then you also became a National Socialist, and then you became a revisionist.
No, I became National Socialist before to become a revisionist. I discovered National Socialism at 14, you know.
Yes, well, that's what I said. Yes, that was before revisionism.
Yes, but at the beginning, I used to believe to gas chambers, etc. And I said to me, "Oh, Hitler made a very, very large mistake, but." We must fight for National Socialism without gas chambers. And people always said to me, "No, you can't fight for National Socialism without gas chambers, because gas chambers, for National Socialism, led to gas chamber." At the beginning, I say, "Well, it's like that. I can't do anything against that." And one day, I discovered the Leuchter report, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But at the beginning, I didn't want to believe with a revisionist thesis. I said, "No, it's impossible." But after, When I read revisionist, and when I saw in France prosecutions against a revisionist, I became a revisionist. And I said to me, "Now, if you want to fight for National Socialism, we have before to fight for revisionism. It's my story."
Yes, you say this, and there's some people have a problem with this, and we have talked about this before when you're on my show previously, but these people think that National Socialists involved in the revisionist movement will hurt the revisionist reputation, and they don't want that. That may be one reason why you're not as well known amongst in the revisionist movement, or I'm not sure, because I think that people think very, very highly of you. So I don't think they let that get in the way, but they will say quite often, in discussions and forums and so on, that National Socialism should not, that many people say that call revisionists Holocaust deniers, because their real purpose is to bring back National Socialism or to change the view about it. And I call that soft revisionism, because these people are, in my opinion, very concerned with not upsetting the Jews. So that's another segment of that in revisionism, there's a whole sector that thinks that we can make things okay with the Jews. We have to give way ourselves, and they'll give way if we give way, and we'll come to some kind of understanding about the Holocaust. And mainly it revolves around the 6 million number and the gas chambers. And these people will use the word Nazis and racists, not speaking about us in particular, but referring to people like us, because in large part they're coming from the left perspective, Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, I didn't understand all what you said. I'm sorry, but I heard you saying that a lot of people doesn't want a National Socialist to be a revisionist. Is that right?
Yeah, they don't want it involved in the revisionist movement or associated and identified with it.
Yes, I think it's a mistake, you know, because even if a revisionist is not a National Socialist, Jews and other person will say to him, even if you are not a National Socialist, you are fighting for National Socialism, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's no use to speak again and to say, no, I'm not a National Socialist. No, I only interesting in truth, etc., etc. It's no use. We are wasting our times. Our time when we speak like that, we have to say, okay, I am National Socialist, but it's not important, you know. If I said that at night there's no sun, even if I am a National Socialist, it's a truth. So when I say there's no gas chamber, it's not important I am National Socialist or not. You have to answer about what I say. I say there's no gas chambers for that reason, this reason, and this other reason. And you have to answer to me, about that. But if you always say, I'm not National Socialist, I'm not National Socialist, they will always say to you are a National Socialist, you are a National Socialist, and it will be finished. But I always say we must speak about gas chamber and Holocaust, not what I am, not what I think. You don't have to consider, you only have to consider what I say, not what I am. I think, and it's my position. I say, when somebody said to me, you are a neo-Nazi, I say, no, not a neo, I am a Nazi. Okay, but now speak about Gerd Schoenberg, please.
Well, that's very good. Thank you, Vincent. You know, but you are a scientist, and Germar Rudolph is a scientist, and many of the true revisionists have a scientific turn of mind if they're not actually trained as scientists. And they do want to do just as you are doing, talk about the facts of the so-called Holocaust. But in the world, things are more political, and people don't care about, you know, as we've sadly found, they don't care about listening to the science when they are more concerned about the politics. And they become very concerned when they're coming from a left perspective that anything to do with National Socialism or the Third Reich or that Germany at that time would come into better favor. They want to keep that kind of held, keep that as something very, very wrong, and yet somehow change the views of revisionism. And I have pointed out many times that this is impossible, and I think you've said the same thing just now. But I don't want to carry on with that. We will go on to speaking of politics. Are you involved with any political party now? Or
no.
At one time you were, it says in your Wikipedia write-up that you were an activist at one time with the French and European Nationalist Party, the PNFE, which no longer exists.
Yes. I used to be on the PNFE, but it was in 1991, and I left this party in 1992 or perhaps 1991. I'm no longer involved in party, in nationalist party, because I think it's not a priority now. We have to fight for revisionism, and after it will be, we will make politics, but for that moment, it's not relevant. Politics is not relevant.
All right, all right. So you are 100% a revisionist, and while you are also a historical revisionist, you're not interested in focusing on politics.
Yes. I say I am a national socialist. Well, okay, sure. But for that moment, in my for example, in my monthly magazine, I never speak about politic ideologies. No, it's not the question for that moment. It's not relevant.
Yes. All right. Well, let's move on now to your work. You have taken on some of the more entrenched myths and stories of German evilness and researched them in depth to find out what really happened, so to speak, and given us some really, really helpful information to combat the lies against the Germans. And as a Frenchman, you have concentrated on some of the official French Nazi history or Holocaust history, as they put it, such as at Oradour sur Glane, which we mentioned already, and the Gestapo and the French resistance, which there's a lot of false stories about how the Germans behaved in France and how the atrocities that they committed against anybody that they arrested, a lot of whom were in the French resistance. And they also, of course, ennoble people in the French resistance when they don't deserve to be portrayed that way as noble characters. But is there anything else that you worked on that is basically about the official French history of that time?
Oh, for the French history, no, I only worked about Oradour, because, you know, it's Oradour, it's for French people, it's our Auschwitz, you know?
Yes.
In Poland, you have Auschwitz, and in France is Oradour. So I only worked about that, and it took me a lot of time, I think seven years to make researches. And after I had to fight against French justice for 5 years, you know. So it's the only thing I worked about French history.
Well, also, I'm including your recent article, research that you did, and it was published in 3 issues of the Barnes Review. It just recently in the January, March, and May issues, 2012, it was translated by Carlos Porter, and I read it in the magazine. Very good. I don't know when you actually wrote that, but I think it tells about all the stories that are in place about the French resistance and what the Gestapo did. And you pretty much put a pin in a lot of that.
Yes. Sorry, I forgot. Yes, it's a second work I made about French history. It's the story of the German police in France during the Second World War. Yes, it's another work I did, but it took me only 6 months to do it. So. I forgot it. Sorry.
Well, people can read that online at www.cwporter.com/Gestapo, and then followed by a space and a .htm. So, and I will link to that. But that is available. Is there any place that people on the internet can read about Oradour sur Glane or what you wrote there? Where would that be available? And is, of course, the book is only in French, but is the book still available?
I think that the book is only in France, in French, sorry, but is not well done. You have you have the book on a site, but you have a lot of mistakes in the text because somebody scanned it and it's not very, very good. But on my site, you have a summary of my thesis, and you have a lot of pictures to understand the story. But I don't think you can find that in another website. You can only find on mine. I think so because perhaps I make a mistake. But I think so
because I looked hard for it and I was very disappointed because I remember a few years ago when I read it, maybe it was this summary on a website, and I can't remember which one it was, but it was in English, and it did have pictures, and it was very interesting, and I couldn't even find it in my files, so I guess I don't know what happened to it, but I was disappointed. I wanted to go there, and I don't know whoever had it up. Somehow it got taken down, I guess.
Yes. I don't know. For the Gestapo, for example, I make a very basic research. I wanted to find the trials after the war of the men who used to belong to the Gestapo, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazing. Because when you read all those trials, you find a lot of new things that I never read in historical books, and I discovered that nobody read. All those trials, you know, nobody. Sometimes I was perhaps not the first, but the second or the third person who wanted to read those trials. So I think, you know, that French historians, I only speak about France, huh? I think that French historians don't work well when they read a book. They don't look in the archives. Mm-hmm. They only read another historian before them wrote. You know,
and well, exactly right.
It's not serious. Okay.
No, they're not. That's why I say it's political. I mean, they're not scientific. The other side of the camp on revisionist, Holocaust revisionism, they're not scientific. They have no desire to be. And they just put out what fits. And we'll get into that in a little bit. The politics that are in place now, and they want to continue because they're defenders of the current political situation that we live under. So, you know, that's amazing. And you find that so often. That's why when people say that everything's been written in Holocaust revisionism, all the work has been done, it hasn't, because you went and looked in these files about these trials and you learned things that nobody had written about yet.
Oh, yes, sure. And you know, sometimes people think that I have a lot of money, or that I know a lot of persons to go in the archives, and etc. And I say no, you don't have to know. You only have to go to the archives and to say I would like to read that. Okay, and everybody can read a lot of transcripts of all those trials. It's very easy, but nobody wants. And I think it's terrible. Sometimes I say we have to work for 100 years to find all that we have to find.
Aha. All right.
Yes, sure. There are a lot of things to do. You can't imagine all the things you can discover. Even, for example, when you read newspaper were published during the occupation, for example, you know, every 15 minutes you make a discover. You say, oh, it's true. Oh, that I didn't know that. And when sometimes I go in a library and I say, well, I will read, for example, Je suis partout, who were published during the occupation. And I say every 15 minutes, I can find another thing, a new thing I didn't know. And I never read anywhere. For example, six years ago, in a library in Paris, I said, well, I will read a monthly magazine during the occupation called Foyer Travail. It means house and work, you know? And suddenly, I discovered a very, very large articles about factory who made the shoes with human hairs, you know?
And oh, shoes out of human hair.
Shoes for home, you know? Not shoes for to walk in the street, but to stay at home. I don't know how to say that in English. You know, it's a little shoes you can wear at home.
Slippers.
Yes, it's that, slippers. But, well, I found a very large article about a factory in France who made slippers with human hairs. And this factory was in Normandy. I live in Normandy, but well, I couldn't find it. But perhaps a day I will make a research about it. So you see, if you only read newspaper published during the occupation, you find a lot of things, and you can win a book with it.
Yes, and you know we should be glad that all this material is still available. When you talked about going into the archives to read about the trials of the Gestapo agents and so on in France, you're obviously, this archive is in the National Archives in Paris or something like that.
Oh yes, but sometimes you know you have the archives in Paris, but in larger libraries you have all the copies, so it's not very difficult to go in a large library, and you can find a lot of copies about a lot of things, very, very different.
Right. So, well, we need people to be making use of this and doing this as you are. You're only one man in France, but because in time some of this may disappear. Once we, the more that we unearth, the more that they will want to cover up what doesn't say what they want it to say. The more, you know, people start looking at it, as long as nobody looks at it, it stays there. But there's always that concern that once we would start looking at it and publishing it more, that pretty soon it won't exist. I worry about this with Elie Wiesel's original Night, that pretty soon the only thing that will be available is his 2006 new translation. But anyway, okay, that was really interesting, and I hope everybody paid attention to that. Now, you have also put out a one-hour video film titled Holocaust, and was this just finished in March? I mean, it has a March 2012 date on YouTube. It is available on YouTube. It is also in French, and you are narrating it.
Yes, it's available on YouTube, and my elder son created a channel called Forbidden Thesis, but in France is Thèse Interdite, you know, and you can and on this channel you can see all my videos and all the Mr. Forisson's videos.
Can you name that channel again?
Yes, it's Forbidden Thesis in English.
Oh,
but in
forbidden,
France,
forbidden. What's the last part?
Thesis, thèse. Forbidden Thesis.
Thesis. Forbidden Thesis. Okay. But all right. And that's great. Your son is helping you with that. That's
yes,
great.
Yes. My elder son helped me. And, you know, at house, I never speak about revisionism because I didn't want my children being fed up with revisionism. So I didn't speak about it. But my elder son himself read a lot of books, and now he helps me, and I'm very proud of him.
Oh, I bet. Oh, that just makes me very happy to hear that. All right, so people can go and see this video, and I watched it. And even though it's in French, there's all the visuals, and you can pretty much follow what's going on. And you just tell the story. You want to give a little concise version of what Holocaust. It's pretty much about why the Holocaust official story and why it's not true, right?
Oh yes, I always in my video and in my works, I always expose. The official history, and after I make answer I make a response or an answer.
Yes.
I don't know.
So yes you and then you refute
I
it.
Don't expose. I don't want to do I don't want to do like court historians. They never expose honestly what we say. Me, for myself, in my opinion, I have to expose honestly.
Yes.
What court historians say, and after I demonstrate that it's not true. But I always say, if you don't expose honestly what a court historian say, you're not a revisionist.
All right. That's good. Good. Good to remember. Now, going on, you have been putting out this magazine, Sans Concession, with no concession, something like that, for quite a while. Tell us about that. Tell us about that.
My monthly magazine?
Yes. How long have you been putting it out, and has it come out every month regularly? That's quite a chore if it has been, because it's a fairly long magazine.
No.
I don't mean real long, but, you know, like 12 or 14 or 16 pages or so.
Yes. No, at the beginning, it was not a monthly magazine, because it was very long, as you said. But now, since 1 month only, it's a monthly magazine, and it's shorter now, you know? And I think it's better for the public, for the readers, because it's not as long as it used to be. And you have now articles a little bit shorter, you know? And I think it's
all right. Well, You're breaking up a little bit.
I think it's a weapon for revisionists, song without concession. Yes?
Yes. Okay.
I don't understand.
You have a subscription list, and you mail it out. I mean, but how is it that the French government allows this to continue? I mean, this has to be against their laws.
Because it's not an official magazine, and officially it doesn't exist, you know. So okay. I mail it, but I have not special price to mail it. And we print this magazine not in France but in Spain, etc. So officially it doesn't exist. We make everything on our own, not to be forbidden by French government.
Vincent, you must be a very, very busy person.
Yes. I am a very busy person, and you know, as I'm not establishment historian, you know, if I don't write articles, and if I have no reader, I can't I won't be able to earn my life, you know.
Okay, all right. Well, we're going to get to that very shortly. In fact, I think we'll skip over this, because we talk about that in the second half. And let's go on to, your prosecutions and convictions in the last, 15 minutes we have here in the first hour. I got this also from Valder Blog, and I'm sure it's correct that starting, tell me if there's anything I need to add, but starting on October 8th, 1992, you were first in front of a court, and you were given 1 month prison, but with a reprieve. That is, you didn't have to serve it, and a fine of 5,000 francs for, you know, I'm not going to even say what you were doing, the usual, for writing about the Holocaust. In June 2004, you were given 24 months in prison over the Orador sur Glane writings that you did. And yes. I can see that the French government would be really upset with that one, because that's, like you say, that's the French Auschwitz. Then on November 8th, 2007, you were sentenced to 1 year in prison and a 10,000 euro fine for, you know, contesting crimes against humanity because of a brochure you put out. Then in June 25th, 2008, in Alsace, France, you were condemned to 1 year of imprisonment and the payment of the cost of placing an advertisement in the official journal of the French Republic, plus some newspapers, including Le Monde, which would have been pretty expensive, because you had to pay for publishing extracts from the court judgment against you. And the League Against Racism and Anti-Semitism in France, LICRA, was very pleased with that. They're the ones who brought that against you. And then on June 19th in 2008, you were again you went to Brussels, and in Brussels they took you to court there and gave you 1 year imprisonment and 25,000 euros in fines. And I'm not sure if you spent any time in prison over those or how all that went. You can tell us. But in 2011 and 12, now, just now, you've got more legal persecution against you. Where do you stand now? And how? And of course, you couldn't pay all that money that they assessed against you, so you didn't have the money. So what's the story with that?
Oh yeah. now today I have no money, and I have no bank account, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I can't have one, because if I have one bank account, they will seize all the money I would be able to earn with private lessons, etc. So no.
Yes, they would seize any money that you have in a bank account. They would seize it to pay for all these past fines. Are you still being held liable for all these fines, or do they just forgive them after a while?
Ah, no. They never give up for what you pay. I will have to pay. Whenever I will earn money, I will have to pay, even if it's in 10 years, for example, you know.
Okay.
So I'll always say that I am a living dead in France. It's finished for me. I can't work. I can't have a bank account. I can't, even if I have money, I can't buy a car. I can't. So it's... Yes, I am a living dead. But, I'll always say to them, I won't pay. I don't want to pay. Even if I have money, I won't pay. And it was 3 or 4 years ago, they wanted me to pay. And I made fake bank bills, you know. And I sent to them and I say, well, if you convict me for fake story, I will send you fake money. And now they don't ask me for money, you know.
you made fake money. Oh, you're too much. That's good.
Yes.
You have a lot of energy and, of course, a lot of good ideas. Well, so now what's your persecution right now? Have you been given a judgment on your latest?
I don't have finished. Oh, I'm sorry, but at that moment I am on probation, and since 40 months I am in probation because I will have a new trial for another thing about revisionism, you know. So I am on probation. I can't go abroad. I can't give a private license to children under 18. I must go to see police. I have to go to the police every week to say, well, I am here. Each week I have to sign at the police, it's not finished for me, and I will have another trial. Because I wrote an article about Dominique Strauss-Kahn on a French newspaper, Rivarol. I wrote an article about him, and they would like to convict me again for contestation of crimes against humanity, etc., etc.
So they want you to stop working and stop writing. They want to shut you up. And
yes, sure.
That's why no matter what you do. Now, let's make this clear to the listeners that you said that you can't work. Nobody would hire you. You can't work anywhere. But you were doing private tutoring and you were making about $3,000 or not 3,000 whatever euros, was it? Something per month doing that. That must have taken up a lot of your time to make that much. And now, but that's for a whole month, that doesn't give you much to live on. And now you only earn $1,100 per month because of these restrictions on your tutoring. You can't tutor anybody over 18. Well, now you're doing whatever you can do as moonlighting off the record. And it's not sufficient for you to live on.
It's not sufficient now. It's very, very hard to work in France to do revisionism, I think. Huh? And a lot of people sometimes, when I want to sell books, they say to me, oh, it's a little bit expensive. But I always say I am 43 now, and I have no house, I have no car, I have nothing. I am like a student, you know. My bedroom is practically empty. It's very very. I have barely a bed, and they can't fight us with arguments. So they try to fight us with money. They want us not to earn money, you know?
Yes, yes, exactly. Well, as for money, we're going to the break in 1 minute, and so I'm going to give an address for people to send you money, and I'm going to wait until we come back from the break to do that, so I won't be rushed. I was going to do it twice, but we'll take care of all that when we get back from the break. And before we go to the break, I want to tell people that the music that I have selected for this program for today is Gute Nacht song from Winterreise, which means Winter Journey by Franz Schubert, sung by the legendary German lieder baritone Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau. And it is the story, tells a little story about a man who is leaving a house and his lover. I don't have time to tell the whole story now, but he's stealing away on a winter moonlit night and saying goodnight to his lover who he doesn't expect to see again.
Herrenhaus, die Liebe das Wandern frei liegen gute Nacht, von einem zu dem anderen frei liegen gute Nacht.
Attention, ça c'est eux là, attention.
We are back now, ladies and gentlemen. I want to take a moment to tell you what I didn't get to tell you about this song. This is Carolyn Yeager on my new Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn program, and my guest today is Vincent Renoir. We will continue in just a moment, but what you just listened to was the Good Nacht song, or Good Night song, from Winterreise, which means Winter Journey, by Franz Schubert, and sung by that great German leader baritone, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau. It's one of my very favorites, but not just me, but favorite of millions of people. And the story is that on a winter moonlit night, a man is leaving the house to which he had come as a stranger and seemed to win the love of the daughter of the house. The mother was encouraging marriage between the two, but now the daughter's love had moved on to a new sweetheart. And so the man, on this particular night, steals away while everyone is sleeping. He writes good night on her door and leaves his footprints in the snow. And these kind of things really move me. So you will hear this again on this program, along with a few other selections that I have for now that will rotate. And I hope you enjoyed it. Well, Vincent, I think we were going along so well. Welcome back to the program.
Oui, thank you very much.
We were just talking, and I think this song fits so well because it is had such a sad quality about it, which I like. I like that kind of minor key music. And we were just talking about the sad situation that you are in. It really fits very well and fits the mood because it is sad. On one hand, you are very victorious and strong and powerful. On the other hand, people should not forget about or ignore the suffering that you have gone through and are going through. And if they care about revisionism and if they care about these issues and they care about the truth, I really urge people to help you out. And you're just going to need help. And you're doing such excellent work, and you're always working. So all of this comes together to say that let's tell people that they can reach you by email if they want to ask questions about how to send money at vincentrenoir@gmx.fr. But also, I'm going to give out a mailing address, and people, you will find this on the program page for this program too. but I'm going to say what it is now. It's Urbain Carat, U-R-B-A-I-N, C-A-R, C-A-I-R-A-T, sorry, C-A-I-R-A-T. That's the first line. Then C period P period 1528. Then on the third line, CH-1820. I think that's like the zip code. Montreux, M-O-N-T-R-E-U-X. And the fourth line, Switzerland. So you can write to Vincent. You can write to me. You can look for it on the program page. And you can send money via PayPal, which I like to use because it's so... They do take a fee, but it simplifies it so much and is quite secure and safe, and the money gets there. Or you can send money in an envelope to this address. Vincent, just like for Americans, dollar bills. I mean, when she it says here bank-bill, and I'm wondering, does that mean banknotes like U.S. dollars? It doesn't mean a check, does it? I don't think you can... handle a check, can you?
Yes. First, thank you very much, Caroline, for this message. And no, it's no problem if persons want to send a bank bill, U.S. dollars, is no problem for us. You know.
Well, what about a check? You know what we call a bank draft check? Does that work for you?
No. There is no check. You know.
No.
Not in Switzerland. For example, you know, a lot of some of German readers send bill bank, and there is no problem. There is no check.
Okay, all right. So when you say that, what we're talking about is for Americans to just put dollars, cash. You know, but cash in the form of dollars. Sometimes people think of checks as cash, but checks in the cash of actual dollars, greenbacks, they used to be, in an envelope and mail it to you. And I've done that too many times, and it always gets there safely. The mail is pretty darn good. So that, or go to your PayPal, and at PayPal, you are under your email address, as everybody is, so it would be at PayPal, VincentRenoir@gmx.fr. Correct?
Yes, it's correct. Thank you very much.
All right.
You know,
well, go ahead.
We need, for example, sometimes I say to persons, if you see for now beautiful paintings, if you can hear beautiful music, it's because in the past all the artists had donations, and for revisionism today it's the same. Without donation, we can't continue.
Vincent, you're breaking up a little bit. I hope we can get the call back. You do come back, so I'll just tell people that you do. Sometimes starting to lose the connection, but we hope we'll hold on to it and it will strengthen. So continue. We lost a little bit of what you just said.
I only said that Mozart without donation. If Mozart didn't have donations, he could have make of the all the music he made. And,
Mozart,
you know,
Mozart, yes, Mozart, right.
Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. So, yeah. For revisionists today, it's the same. If you sometimes people say to me, "Oh, but now we know. We don't want to know anymore. We are convinced. We are convinced. Gashenberg didn't exist, etc. So it's finished for us. We won't read you anymore. We are convinced. It's enough." And I say to all these persons, "But if you want, why did you know revisionism? Because at the beginning, some persons gave money for revisionists, for the for revisionist cause. They gave money, so it was possible to print books, to speak on little radios, to make researches, etc. But so if you don't give money, but the next generation won't know revisionism. So think to that before being selfish to say, well, I am convincing. It's finished now. But it's not finished. Perhaps for you it's finished. Perhaps you are convinced. But think about new generation and next generation. We must have money to print books, to make a website, for example. When a lot of my texts are on my website, but it's free for young people and for all the texts because they are not rich. But if people who have money don't give money, it will be the end, you know?
Yes. Yes, exactly. You know, I agree. And it's very hard for us to part with money. Most of us, you know, if you have to pay for something in order to do it, I'm wondering if it's me that's dropping and not you. Can you hear me now, Vincent?
Yes, yes, I can hear you very well. There's no problem for us.
Okay, all right. I hope we're still on the air. I can hear you. Something just left the looking to see for when that happens, who it is. All right. When we, what was I going to say? I threw myself off there. When we don't have to pay for something, like you say, what's on the internet is free. I put things for free. I do everything for free. All kinds of people do everything for free, make it available. And then there are people and some in our own movement of one sort or another who start charging for things. And some people will pay for it. And sometimes, you know, we can think that if you charge for things, people are willing to pay for it because they think it has more value. But I don't think that's a good idea because we reach more people this way. And what we want to do is reach people. And we just have to expect our supporters to understand that and to support. Now, I'm glad this came up this way because I have been wanting to make some points about that people should really think carefully about who they give their money to. If they have a certain amount of funds that they're able to donate to different good causes, nationalist causes and revisionist causes and so on, that they should think very clearly about who is doing the best work, who is doing the most work, and who is just has been just collecting money for many, many years. And there are people who are used to sending it to them. But you have to ask, what are they doing now? What are they doing with it? A lot of people are living off of it. And you have to live off of it because you have been put into a position where you have no other means. But some of these other people are not quite that way. So, I don't want people to think I'm talking about this, that, or the other person. But I just say that really think carefully and put your money where it's going to do the most good. We'll repeat that again at the end of the show if we have time. Now, it goes without saying that in 2008, you wrote that it goes without saying that the stakes involved are gigantic ones, and the implications of Holocaust revisionism extend well beyond the historical scope of just it, because it goes, you say, you wrote this in 2008, that it is goes into political and even theological issues, and that the world order was founded at Nuremberg in 1945-46. So it's this entire world order that was founded at that time, based on, in large, the Holocaust has played a large part in that, and increasingly is playing an even larger part. You know, was constantly being brought up as the what we have to avoid, and so this is what we're dealing with, something huge, huge, not just one little wartime atrocity that took place. And then you point out that a small that revisionists are presented as a small sect of cranks that are just denying the obvious, and at the same time they have all these special laws passed all over Europe. In some countries like Germany and Austria, they're even more strict than in France. And resolutions are adopted at the UN to deal with these people who are called Holocaust deniers. So you say this is a flagrant discrepancy between what they're saying. You know, on the one hand, it's just a bunch of dummies like flat earthers. And on the other hand, they have to put up this incredible edifice to prevent anybody hearing their message. Do you want to add anything to that?
Although I think that you explained very well the situation. On one hand, they say revisionists are madmen, and on the other hand, yes, they make special laws and etc. etc. When I see, for example, in my situation, you know, so I have no money. I can't speak on the radio, on the French radio, I think. I can't go to the television. When I print a book, perhaps you have, for example, I don't know, but it's no more than 1,000 books, you know.
Yes. Small.
I am a drop in the ocean, but I am a drop, but they are always saying that we want Vincent Renoir not to speak anymore, etc., etc. So, it's a proof that we are right, and that
yes.
your fight is very, very important, because when you have only a drop on the ocean, it doesn't matter. But no. All the Jewish, etc., it real matter.
That's right. It's so important. We, you know, they put so much effort into it, and people should keep that in mind. And then you sum up by saying that, therefore, the way ahead is laid out for us. And I always like to get to the bottom line. You say we must continue to repeat the truth, the whole truth, including the truth about what's at stake in this struggle. And this sometimes is forgotten about by what I call the soft revisionists, because they want to prove certain things about the Holocaust, but they don't want to make such a huge change in the situation that we're in which we already said has been put in place. It was founded in 1945 in 1946 at Nuremberg. So they have a different objective with the truth. And so, I agree with you that this is a struggle that goes beyond just an argument about what happened to the Jews in 1942 through 1945 in Germany or by the Germans. So, and you say, again, and we talked about this before, the continuation, this fight is a continuation on the intellectual level of the war whose armed phase ended in 1945 with the defeat of the Axis forces. And so these are things that I think in a way have to be talked about, because this is kind of like the area that revisionists don't want to talk about. Well, we don't want to get caught up in fighting about it, but there is the idea of I'm getting myself caught up in something I don't want to talk about right now, but that, well, you end by saying that National Socialist Germany embodied the very last attempt to return to a well-ordered society. And it's a difference of opinion, I guess, between what kind of a society is acceptable to us, and not, we don't all share the same idea on that, but we do share the same thoughts about scientific revisionism. And so that's where you probably want to keep our attention. Let's go on to, unless you have something you want to say about that, we'll go on to some of your, we'll go on to Orador, Sword Lane, and I would like you to tell us just exactly what happened there, both the official version and what you found out, because I think this is a really important aspect of history. Do you want to add anything to what we were just talking about?
No. Your summary is very well. So about Oradour, Oradour-sur-Glane in France, it's quite simple, you know. The official story says that Waffen-SS went in the village on 1944, June 1944, exactly the 10th of June 1944. It will be tomorrow the anniversary of the event, you know. And official story so says that Waffen-SS went in the village without any reason and killed the men before, and after they put the woman and the children in the church, and they killed them putting fire on the church, you know. They burnt them, so. And they burnt 60 women and, 600 women and 600, sorry, 600 women and children in the church.
Yes.
But, you know, this story is stupid, because official thesis said that after German wanted to give a reason for this slaughter, for this massacre, and they wanted to say that it was a slaughter made to say to French people, well, be quiet. If you are not quiet, if you fight against us, we will burn a lot of village, etc., etc. But at the same time, they said that German wanted to say, no, it's not our fault. It's not our fault. It was about resistance, French resistance, etc., etc. But, you know, if you burn all a village to fear people, you don't, after you don't try to give an excuse. You don't try to say, well, it's not our fault, it's a French resistance fault, etc. So at the beginning, I was surprised, and I say, what's the matter in this village? And the second thing was, it's stupid killing women and children in a church, burn women and children in a church is very, very stupid, because a church is very difficult to put fire on, you know. And if you want to kill women and children, you can easily kill them with a machine gun, etc. So I said this story is very, very strange, and um, I said this story is very, very strange, and I wanted to make research about it, you know. And the first thing I made, it's go in the village and to see the church, because today the church is as it was in 1944. So I went to the village, and to see the church, and to say, well, what's the matter in the church? And it was not very difficult to understand that the church the church exploded, you know. And if the church exploded, it was not the fault of the German, the Waffen-SS, but because they didn't have things they didn't have things to make an explosion in the church. But it was the French resistance fault because they used to hide weapons in the church. It was my first discovery. So
okay, well, can you tell us a little bit about the French resistance and how it's been overblown in its presented as this great patriotic movement?
In the Oradour region, mm-hmm. the French resistance was very, very active, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere resistance was living and fighting, because it was a communist region, you know.
Yes, okay, and they were living amongst the people in the villages. Yes.
Yes, it's the best way to make resistance. It's living among the people. If you try to hide in a forest, for example, it won't be very difficult to find you. But if you live among people, like in Russia, it's easier to fight an army, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so
these resistance members in this area were mostly communists, and were a lot of them also Jewish, or was there not that many Jews amongst them?
No. There were not many Jews, and I think that in Oradour, one family was a Jew family, but only one. So there's no Jews involved in the Oradour events. You know, in Oradour's events. No, there's no Jews. I think so, and I am practically sure.
But communists.
Yes, sure. Yes. And you know, for myself, I am an historian, and I don't have to say, well, it was communist. It was, well, for me, it was French resistance. That's all.
Okay. All right. Good.
So I made a research, because it's very hard to set on fire a church. I found the church had exploded, and I was the first historian. Well, I'm not an historian, but I was the first historian to go in the archives and to find things nobody found before me. And it's because I was able to read, to write a very, very large book about Oradour's events. And I went and I discovered some a lot of persons who survived to the slaughter, you know. And so I ask them a lot of questions, and they give me answers. And with all that information, it was easy for me to reconstruct the real story.
Okay, and the real story was?
Well,
just real quickly so we can go on to, but I would like people to know about this.
The real story is very simple. A French resistance made prisoners, German prisoners, and there was a high rank prisoner, you know.
Yes. And yes.
All the other Waffen SS wanted to keep him. They wanted to deliver to rescue him. Yes, to rescue him, and they made research, 24 hours research, and they discovered that this prisoner was in Oradour. So they went in Oradour, and they said to the woman and the children, well, you don't have to be involved in this matter, so we will put you on the church, and we will ask to the men where is the prisoner. And at a moment, the church exploded, and we are sure that there were weapons in the church. But today we don't know very well what's the matter in the church. Why the weapons exploded? It's a mystery. I'm sure that a lot of person knows, but they won't tell us the truth. So it's a mystery. I think that some woman said to the German, to the Waffen SS, well, the resistance, you have resistance in the church. And after a little, the Waffen SS wanted to catch the resistance in the church, and all the weapons exploded during this action. But it's only an hypothesis. It's not sure.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. So they found a good way, just like with so many other incidents. They just said, well, the Germans did it. The Germans, wanted to, an atrocity. They murdered all these women and children, and then they shot the men or whatever, and they just came to this village and wiped it out. And they leave out all the facts that tell a different story. And this is an important one because, like you say, the French people are so enamored of it, and they hold on to this as why they should continue to believe that the Nazis were capable and the SS was vicious and they were capable of doing all these things that they're told that they did.
Yes.
So okay, go ahead.
Oradour is a symbol, you know. Oradour is a symbol of the Nazi atrocities in France.
Yes, yes. The poor Nazis.
Yes.
Anyway, let's go on. Thank you for all that. And let's go to your latest project, which is what you have on your website and what you did for Robert Faurisson. Now, to give a little background here, just recently Robert Faurisson came out and praised you highly and said that he was getting old and did not really have the energy to do what he used to do, and he hoped to pass it on, to pass the torch over to you as the premier French revisionist, I guess, in people's minds, and that he was concerned because you were having such financial difficulties that you had said you couldn't continue unless you had some relief on that in that area, and previous, probably the one reason why Robert Forreston is so concerned about you is because you did respond to this charge by some so-called non-historians who call themselves Holocaust historians, who attacked his position on no holes, no Holocaust, for which Robert Forreston is famous for coming up with that statement. For people who are not really into revisionism, this is talking about the crematoriums in Birkenau, and particularly crematorium 2, but maybe 3 too, where there's no hole. They're found, you know, revisionists have determined quite well that there are no holes in the roof that supposedly this Zyklon B was thrown down. And so Robert Forreston said, no holes, no Holocaust. Well, this held for quite a while. He kind of challenged people to show otherwise. And then these three people came up and wrote something, which I have not read. But there, you gave me their names earlier, so I'll name them so my English speaking listeners can get it clear. They are Jamie McCarthy and Daniel Karan. And Ari Mazel, and they, you say that they are not historians, but they did put together a serious challenge to Robert Forreston's, to the No Holes, No Holocaust. And Robert Forreston said he was not going to respond to it. He didn't think it was important, but you did think it was, you do think it, and still do think it was, it's important to respond. Because what they put together, while you said it's not satisfactory, but it looks good. It looks good, and people will be convinced by it, because we're getting now into a lot of technical stuff that very few people are going to pay attention to. But you feel, as a serious historian yourself, and you are a historian even though you don't have a history degree, that we need to answer these things. And so you spend a lot of time answering it, and Forreston is no doubt grateful for that too, and because you have the energy that he just doesn't have anymore. So I want you to tell us about that. It's in French, and it's on this website we gave the link to earlier, and I'll have it on the program page. But it's very long, and it's in French, but you can click on a lot of links, and also there's where it says click here or cliquez ici. You can click and look at all the diagrams and pictures which you have included. And you yourself drew these diagrams. It, like we say, you're an engineer by training, and you do some beautiful drawings. And so even that, you know, if you can't read it in French, you can follow it along to some degree by looking at all these documents and images that you put on there. So, go ahead.
I even made a scale model of the crematorium with a chimney, you know, to give an answer to to the court historians. So I wanted to make a scale model, because it's better than draw a diagram with a scale model. You can't cheat, you know. It's a truth. So to give an answer to my contradictors, I worked a lot, and I took photography on the scale model, etc. to prove that they were wrong.
Okay, and this is at www.phdnm.org. And so, you know, tell us about it, describe it, so that we can generally understand what it is that you showed to show that they are wrong in saying that that Forreston was wrong.
Well, for example, they wanted us to believe that on the wall today, on the roof, sorry, not on the wall, but on the roof, you can see three of the four cheminée, you know. But it's not true. Faurisson said it's not original oil. It's a roof broke during the explosion, you know, and so you have some holes, but it's not originally holes, and it's true, and you know they want us to believe that on a aerial photography took in August of 1944, we see the holes, and we can see even if you can take the photography in with a third dimension, you can see the cheminée with her third dimension, etc. And I proved it. It's wrong because the photography wasn't enough precise, wasn't enough good to see all the things they want us to believe that we have to see.
Yes, well, those are the photographs that John Ball analyzed, right? And has shown, and Germar Rudolph has it on his website now. You can download, or you can just view the entire book that was put out by John Ball, which I've never seen it all together like that. And these particular photos, air photos that you're talking about, are the most impressive of all because it shows that they were drawn on to make these little marks that don't even look like holes. They look like big marks. And so it's all done by intelligence agencies.
Well, you know, I don't think, personally, I don't agree with John Ball. I don't think it's marks. I think it's things who did really exist, but it's not chimney, you know. But Perhaps I am wrong, but I don't.
Well, they also drew fences around. There's a lot of strange things that don't look like anything real. They look like drawing. But anyway, but you're saying that you have, you used other evidence than that.
Well, yes, I have other evidence. And, you know, we have documentary evidence, you know, at Auschwitz, for example. Whatever you made, a door, a new light, etc., you had to put your work on a sheet, you know, to have money, to have workers, etc., etc. And for the four halls, there is no document, nothing. And all the... today on the roof, you don't have a single remaining of those holes. The holes they show you they are not square. It's holes after destructions of the roof, you know. We have a lot of evidence. It's not easy for me to explain. You know, but there is a thing.
It sounds though like these three men, McCarthy, Karan, and Mazal, didn't come up with anything new. They just came up with the same old stuff, showing these pictures of broken places in the roof that are supposed to be original insertion holes, right? I mean, they have nothing. They have no good evidence.
Oh no, they don't have good evidence, and they didn't. Yes, you're right. They didn't bring new things, but they wrote an article which seems very serious, but it's not quite new, you know.
Yeah.
but it's very, very well done, and it looks very scientific.
Okay.
And you know about this thing, Carlo Mattonio gave an argument which is wrong too. So I think we must be careful when we want to give an argument. We have to check it more and more again and again before before saying it. And in my article, I say no on the on that thing. Carlo Mattonio is not true. He made a mistake. I think that we can if that another revisionist made a mistake, we have to say it and to say no, it was not. It was wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, you're right. But there is the idea that these people come up with these things, like this new book or article, whatever it is, that looks to a challenge in order to keep us busy answering these things that have already been answered. But if you you study things very carefully, obviously, and if you see that they have some points that haven't been answered or need to be answered, or they might have something correct in there that you think that we need to respond to that. You're very thorough. I didn't know that you were so thorough, actually. Because there are some who have, like Carlo Mattonio has a reputation for being very thorough and wanting to cover every little point. Would you agree with that, or what is your assessment?
Well, yes, I have a lot of confidence in Carlo Mattonio, on Carlo Mattonio, I mm-hmm. think he's very, very good researcher, etc. But for that argument, it was wrong because it was everybody can make a mistake. But I repeat, I have a good confidence in Carlo Mattonio.
Okay. Well, so what do you hope, what has been the response to your article refuting this by these three guys? And what do you hope to accomplish with it? Is it getting around? Are people able to read it? Is it only still in French?
Well, my article, I put my article on my website,
Yes.
And I wait for a response. I said, well, my contradictor will make a response, and nothing came, since now 2 years. And in France, I say I will give 5,000 euros if you can show me that gas chamber existed. Nobody dare to speaking with me,
Yeah. So these three men, they wrote this refuting what Faurisson said, a long thing, and you answered it.
Yes.
And it was something very long. Took you a long time to do, and was very good. And now they though don't answer you. They won't answer you.
They didn't. Their article was first published in Holocaust and Genocide Studies, a very well-known magazine.
Okay.
Their article was published in this review.
Okay, so that's why these were people who are taken seriously. And even though their argument was not very good, they're still taken seriously, and it was in this serious journal, which is taken seriously. So you did answer it, you did all that, and they have not come back with any response.
Nothing.
Said. Very good. Well, but and they won't, will they?
You know, I think that now they don't read revisionist. I would like to give you only one example. Kurt Gerstein.
Yes.
The SS who made testimony in 1945.
Yes. Now, for the listeners, he is one of the most believable to people who don't know any better. You know, he's one of those witnesses who are supposedly an SS who knew what was going on, and he testified against the Nazis in the trials. And wrote a yes. book, right? Did he write a book?
No, he didn't. He okay. only wrote a confession, but we have six versions of his confession. Well, but in 1964, a French historian, Leon Poliakov, wrote an article about Gerstein. And you know, Gerstein said that at Belzec, in a gas chamber, there were 7,000 people on, I think it was 25 square meters, you know,
mm-hmm.
which is impossible. And in 1964, Poliakov wrote an article, and it changed what said Gerstein. He said 70,000 people on 93 square meters. But Gerstein never said 93 square meters. And in 1985, a revisionist, Henri Roch.
Who is that?
Henri Roch, you know?
Okay.
Henri Roch.
Okay, all right. Rocks. Yes.
He made a thesis, a universe thesis about Gerstein.
Thesis.
He made a universe thesis about Gerstein. And he proved that Poliakov changed the confession of Gerstein. Well, and we said, well, now Poliakov is finished. Nobody won't print his article again because he was very dishonest. But, well, 1 month ago, a very known review in France called La Shoah Review. Well,
Shoah Review.
Yes, it's a thing like that. It's a print again the Poliakov article. And I said, well, I think that they will change because Poliakov wrote 93 square meters, but it was 40 years ago. Now they will put the real. It's 25 square meters. But no, they didn't do that. They print again the article written by Poliakov without changing. But everybody in the revisionist knows. All the revisionists know that it's Poliakov is a liar, but they didn't change his article because they don't read revisionists. For they say, well, revisionists are liars, and we don't have to read them. So it's why I think nobody will give a response to my work on the halls.
Well, right, and they don't want to respond to anything, and they come right out and say they're not going to do so. And so they have all the advantage of having their material published and promoted and put in newspapers and yes. so on and reviewed, and we don't. So they don't have to do any of that.
Yes, and they don't have to read us and to give a response, but it will be impossible for us. But even if they were able, they don't have to do that. They have all the money, all the newspaper, television, radio, so they even don't read us. They don't consider us. Not at all.
Yes, that's right. Now, this leads me, and we only have a few more minutes left, this leads me to a question I was going to ask you, and I passed these by earlier, didn't get back to them. If you had all the money, if money was no object, Vincent, what project, what would you do for revisionism? What would you use it for?
If I have money, I would like to make a lot of work, but, you know, I would like to make a work.
But even beyond what you would do, well, it could be what you would do. But, I mean, if we had all the money we wanted, what would be the most important thing for revisionists to do?
Yes, if I had all the money I wanted, I think that I would make a very large website with a lot of videos for the young people, for the next generation, you know. Today, young people, they don't want to read, they want to see and to watch films. And if I had a lot of money, I would make a lot of videos about Oradour, about a lot of things to promote revisionism to the future generation. I would like to promote revisionism among the next generation.
Yes. All right, and you think the way to do that is with videos?
Oh yes.
And even major films. But again, you know, they do films and they get them in theaters and so on, and they win Academy Awards. And we do films and we have a hard time. But there is YouTube. Is there anything else? I mean, they show all these Holocaust films in schools. And if we, you know, it's one thing to make this stuff. It's another thing to get the access. I guess we would, if we had all the money, we should buy our own. We would buy our own major networks and publishing companies and movie studios. Yeah, yes. And then when you make these things, we would have a way to distribute them.
Yes, yes, sure. Well, I would like, for example, to take their film and make a response to see what they say. Look at this scene, and now I will respond. I will give an answer, you know, like that. I think it's the best thing to do.
Yes, all right. Well, Vincent, we have less than a minute to go, so... on this program, I want to thank you so much, Vincent Renoir from France, for being my guest today. I've just enjoyed it very much, and I want to remind people that your email address is vincentrenoir@gmx.fr, and they can use this address that I'm going to give and that I've already given. I don't have time to even give it again. Spell it out. But or PayPal using that email address of yours to send you money, and that you've also requested that people come up with a small monthly donation, so that something that you can depend on. So we didn't get a chance to discuss that, but I want to thank you. Good night, Vincent. Thanks for being my guest.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much to everybody.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.